Nutmeg Radio
with Lauren and Nadia.
Nutmeg.
You are tuning in to Nutmeg Radio.
Welcome back to Nutmeg Radio. Today we have a guest, Eric, who goes by the Corporate Mystic. Eric, do you want to give us a little rundown on what it is that you do as a Corporate Mystic?
Well, first off, thanks, Lauren, and thanks, Nadia, for having me on your podcast. It feels really nice to have this conversation. Already I'm loving all the background discussion we've been having before we hit record, so I have a really good feeling about this time that we're about to spend together. Thank you very much. To call myself a corporate mystic, I've discovered that my worldview is rooted in practical mysticism. And what that is, it's operating with an assumption that our existence comes from a place that is beyond our reach, and that everything we experience is like an echo of that. And from there, we can trust that everything is unfolding and giving us feedback, and we get to receive that feedback as data. And all of that comes from the way that we're being, basically. It comes from the way that, from the qualities that we're embodying. And we get to put our energy into that. We get to put our energy into how present we are, how compassionate we are, how discerning we are, how valiant we are, whatever qualities we embrace. And then that then unfolds into the results that we get. So for me, being a corporate mystic basically equates to working with the mystery rather than working either in ignorance of it or against it. So it's being willing to let go and trust and surrender without completely collapsing, by basically working on ourselves, working on our culture, the trust in our organizations, looking at our industry and looking at all of capitalism and all of society as an experiment that's giving us data about how we're being in this moment. So yeah, sure, maybe things aren't going in a direction that feels life-supporting, that feels auspicious or sustainable or even benevolent. For me being a mystic, in a sense, I trust in the benevolence of everything about our existence, that once I'm able to enter into a state of mastery with myself and a state of being that supports life, supports prosperity, supports happiness, that then that's going to unfold. And I also trust in society. I trust in our economy. I trust in organizational life. I trust in humanity, that we're capable of being that and of producing that result.
I literally just had my shoulders like drop down my back, like tuning into your trust. So I really enjoy that. And I really enjoy how you're really bringing two worlds, two very polarized worlds together, because I think that's the work at the end of the day. Like, you know, we're all householders. We all have like businesses. We all like need to go and make a living and go about our lives. Like, we can't kind of like just take ourselves off and just live in meditation all the time. And so like actually being able to bring mysticism, like I use the word magic because I work more in the magician realms than the mysticism realms, but essentially they're very similar paths, right? Being able to actually bring that in a practical sense, I think, is why we do this. And I think like it's spreading such a powerful message, because it's saying like, yeah, this isn't just for like yogis who disappear and like are hippies and go off and do whatever. This is for everyone. Like, this can benefit everyone, like whether you're in corporate life, you know, on Wall Street, or whether you're a stay-at-home mom. This work is literally for every single human being, because it improves the quality of your life.
Yeah, and it's especially important for those of us who are householders, who are in positions of formal authority, decision makers, leaders, critical workers, for those of us who are contributing members to society, who are holding a lot about where we're headed, for those of us to take responsibility for how we're being and to do this work, and to honor ourselves and to honor those we love and those who we serve. There's a huge opportunity right now because we have so many tools that are so potent. It's like all of the ancient wisdom, all the medicines, all the practices, is basically coming to us all at once in this generation at this time right now. And the way that I like to think of it is, some of us have a crisis where everything needs to change. Maybe it's a health crisis. Maybe it's a career crisis, or something happens. And then we go through a dark night of the soul. And then we leave what we thought was our path for a few years. And then we come back transformed. Sometimes it happens that way. I believe that we don't need to drop everything in order to transform ourselves. And the metaphor that I like to use is, rebuilding or transforming an aircraft into a spaceship mid-flight. So rather than needing to land the plane and then retool or adapt our vessel and then take off to go at a higher altitude or to go, interplanetary or interstellar, I believe it's possible to do that mid-flight. We have the tools, we have the guidance, and frankly, we have the need, the absolute life or death need to do that right now. And I believe that there's still time for us to turn this whole thing around and to create a really prosperous, beautiful, life-giving world. It's just that we need to listen and pay attention, and have the courage to step up to the plate and do this. And there's so many excuses. It's like, well, if I do this, then I'm going to fall behind. Or if we change the way that we do business, we're not going to be competitive anymore in the marketplace. We're going to lose market share and we're going to go out of business. Or we need to report to our shareholders and we have metrics we need to meet. Or even something as simple as, what are my friends going to think of me? I'm going to get rejected or ostracized, or I'm going to disappoint a mentor, or I've invested my whole career into this, and then finally I'm at the top, and now you're telling me that everything's going to need to change, right? There's so many reasons why we as individuals are change resistant. And I've worked in the energy industry for almost 15 years now. And I've seen so many cases of legacy industry incumbents being change resistant. And there's a familiar pattern that I see, which is that at first people will glaze over. It's almost like they don't want to see that there's a new technology or that there's a new business model. Then they'll start putting up objections that are of a technical nature. Like, you know, it can't work for this or that reason. And then finally, they'll get to the heart of it and say, well, basically, what it boils down to is, well, the world is too greedy or cynical, or, you know, people will be unwilling to do this. And once it gets to that, well, then we're starting to get closer to the real issue, which is an internal issue. It's our unwillingness to grieve what is no longer serving us, so that then we can make the space and welcome a whole new paradigm. And this resistance to change is totally nonsensical often, because if you lay it out, it's like everybody wins a lot of times. However, there's a period of uncertainty during which we can perceive that there's winners and losers. And the tragedy of uncertainty is that where our mind goes is in perceiving it as downside immediately. When there's uncertainty, we look at, okay, what could I lose? And that's been shown in behavioral science. I think it's expectation theory. What we need to remind ourselves is that uncertainty has both downside and upside. And especially in a scenario where ultimately everyone wins, It really makes a lot of sense to embrace the upside. However, the emotional experience of that process is not necessarily easy for most people.
Yeah, it's so fascinating, I think, as well, because these people who are at the helms of these big corporate structures, they, to me, from what I've understood from meeting people and stuff, they don't often have that ability to step outside their kind of masculine linear construct, as you say, of like having to meet these sort of these deadlines and these requirements from, you know, bigger parts of this establishment. And yeah, I'm intrigued to know, like, how do you find your clients? And I think it's exciting because you have a tap into these people who sit at this higher level already. They're moving and kind of shaking and stuff. And yeah, I'm intrigued to know how you find these people. And is it kind of few and far between at the moment, or are you sort of seeing that there is like a big shift at those upper levels? Because I think once that happens, that ripple effect of company culture and the way that people actually operate, like that's where the magic happens.
Yeah, well, I haven't been marketing myself too heavily until recently. Where I've been putting a lot of my energy is in leading by example in the work that I'm doing as an economist. So I still work in the energy industry. I'm doing a lot of regulatory work and electricity market design reforms and also commercializing some technologies and things like that. And I've really witnessed a shift in the impact that I'm having on teams, on people during negotiations. And it's been enlightening, to say the least, because I can see the proof that all of this work that I've been doing is bearing fruit. I have a few coaching clients who I've been working with for a long time, and I've been really fortunate that when someone starts to work with me, typically, they want to continue working with me. Actually, always, they want to continue working with me over the long run, and I get to grow and evolve with them. So it's a I see it as a multi-year or like decade-long partnership, where I'm someone who they can come to who really understands them and understands their context, and then can also challenge them. And I get to grow with them, and they get to grow with me. Because I put a lot of resources and energy and devotion into my own process of personal growth and my own journey of mastery. And then I get to bring that to the people who I'm guiding. I'm literally serving them or guiding them. And clearly everyone needs a guide. Yeah, everyone can benefit from a guide, kind of like Luke Skywalker has Yoda. Luke Skywalker is very much the protagonist, and Yoda plays an important role as a guide. Yeah, and then recently I've started speaking a lot more in public and putting out content. And for example, this podcast is case in point of that. And I feel like the world is becoming ready for what I have to share and what I have to say. And by ready, I mean the world is ready to engage with it and do this work and to integrate it and implement it and demonstrate the importance and the results of doing that work. And that's on an individual level, and it's also at the team level, and it's also at the cultural level of an organization. And then all of that unfolds and translates into strategy, into industry dynamics. And then ultimately into policy. And the way that I find clients, well, the way they find me. And that's where the public speaking and this conversation, right? So if somebody's watching this or listening to this conversation that we're having now, I would definitely invite you to reach out to me. And I love having drop-ins with people and getting to know your world. And then to the extent that there's a strong resonance and an opportunity to create value together in your world, then we can explore that.
Super cool. I mean, you've had quite an interesting sort of background from my knowing you. So I met Eric at our yoga Kundalini teacher training in India last year. And yeah, we just had a great time. We traveled a little bit after that as well. And yeah, I actually can tap back into a lot of our mornings in the Golden Temple at Amritsar. And I can really feel even now how important it was for us to be there and then to go and see the Dalai Lama and all these amazing things. And on our long car journeys from one place to the other, I got to know you a lot more. And I found it so cool that, you know, you've had like quite the in-depth, like you're an amazing musician. You have this ability for sound and vibration, and your background in your music realms, and then your business realms, and then your cacao, and it's the best cacao I've ever had. So I'm obsessed. It's just, yeah, you're a very interesting person. And I love like all of these little bits and pieces that you've pulled in your life that you can now take that into these corporate spaces and change the world by all of these kind of tools that you've pulled together. And it's the same thing as what Nadia and I, we're doing as well in our spaces. And I think, yeah, it's super cool. So yeah, I guess how is your kind of music, your understanding of the Nad and vibration, like how is that encompassing sort of your growth and time and space at this point? I'm intrigued.
Well, music has been a part of my life for over 25 years now, and it tracks really well with how I've grown personally. So at the beginning, when I was playing music, I was very competitive. I wanted to be the best, basically. And I remember my whole high school was separated between my camp and the camp of this other drummer who we were both teaching. And we had like our followers, call it, like who were learning from us, and we would almost have standoffs in the hallways, you know. And then the battle of the bands got really hot and things like that. So it was a big part of my personality that I wanted to dominate. And I would stay after school, I would stay in the practice room 4 hours and just practice. And then from there, I got scholarships in college, and then I did session work. I played all over the world and played in different bands like hip hop and metal and you name it. And at one point, my whole life, my career, everything came to a head. And that was the moment where things shifted for me. And then I discovered a whole other way of expressing myself musically, which is much more of service. I discovered ceremony music and sound healing. The whole yogic and plant medicine and all of these realms, the way that sound is utilized. And you mentioned Nad, right? Even appreciating the vibration of the words that we're chanting, and chanting them as a prayer, and then feeling our body vibrating and attuning to those sounds. In ceremonies, playing as an act of pure devotion and service, and not really looking to be technically impressive or anything like that, literally just playing for the people who are receiving, who are in their own process, and supporting that process. And that really shifted a lot how I experience music and how I play. I don't even think of it as performing anymore, right? At that point, it's just expressing myself and sharing. And I've softened a lot. And I've opened my heart a lot. And I've learned to live from an open heart, which is the single most fundamental shift that anyone can make at this point in our generation. It's the zeitgeist of our generation, which is to make this journey. It's not a long journey, and it's an infinitely long journey, yeah, of going from being having a very mental orientation to being heart-centered. Because then we're able to transcend the suffering of separation and the madness of the tyranny of our thoughts, and to come home to a place where we have infinite wisdom and infinite bliss. And then that becomes a source of energy. So we're no longer in this zero-sum game of having to take energy from each other, because there's not enough to go around. At that point, we're connected to a boundless well of energy. You could call it love. You could call it whatever. And at that point, we're able to just give. And it completely changes the dynamics in our environment just by that shift in our way of being. So that's perhaps the most fundamental example of the shift that I see happening on a global level. Once I'm able to be self-sufficient in giving myself love and safety and fulfillment, then that echoes and reverberates through the people who I'm connected with on a day-to-day basis. And then that then translates into the work that we're doing. And then over time, or perhaps quickly with the right guidance, that then scales into the culture of a whole enterprise. And then it transcends also into the dynamics of an industry, right? Once we're no longer in a zero sum game where the Nash equilibrium is to just, you know, try to undercut each other. at that point, we're able to create a whole lot more prosperity. Because that's how game theory works, right? When we're all collaborating, there's a whole lot more to go around. The collaboration includes for us to let go of consumerism and the growth imperative as the ultimate economic objective, creating situations where people are constantly needing our product, like in medicine, for example, and needing to control the outcome of education. And like, there's so much that we can let go of, because at that point we get to trust the unfolding, because we're connected to a source of energy that's boundless.
On point.
Yeah. And music has been a big part of that discovery for me. So you ask me what's the significance of music and artistry in my life. Well, I get to go to places and have experiences that are extraordinary. I get to get a glimpse beyond the veil in some of these artistic experiences. And then I get to carry that with me and share it.
Love it.
I have a couple of questions off the back of that. Firstly, can you explain for anyone listening, because I'm sure there will be a few people, what the Nard means? I mean, I have a basic understanding based on my own kind of like meditational, contemplation. But I think that's an important place for us to go. And also, what was your tipping point to like, you said that you came to a head in your life. So are you able to dish the tea on both? Yeah.
Well, I probably won't give you the best answer for what the Nard is. We have some teachers, Lauren and I, who would definitely do a much better job than me. Well, the Nard is, the way that I understand it, it's sound vibration. And ultimately, everything comes down to frequencies, yeah? So there's a theory in physics that reconciles quantum physics and relativity. So these are two different theories of the fundamental forces of the universe, or the physics of the universe. Relativity was brought forward by Albert Einstein. It's very elegant, beautiful, right? E equals MC squared. However, there are some limitations. There are some aspects of reality as we observe it that relativity doesn't quite explain. And then quantum physics is not elegant. It's quite, it's a lot of data and a lot of computation and crunching, and the equations are really long, and right, it's not an elegant theory. And I think intuitively we can understand that ultimately we want to have a very beautiful and elegant theory of everything, a God equation. And that's where string theory comes in, and that's the best attempt that's been made, and it's still being explored. And there's always new physics coming. And now with the evolution of technology that's happening, we're going to be moving even quicker towards that asymptote. And so string theory basically holds that everything is energy and vibration, and there's somehow, the way that I understand it is consciousness is the conductor. Yeah. And then from this soup of everything and nothing, manifestation comes into being. And the way that I understand Nod is that it's basically resonating with us as energy through the sounds. So it's basically it's a very fundamental force of nature, meaning the natural world being even beyond life, right? Everything about nature. Mantras that have been recited for a very, very long time have developed a signature, an energetic signature, because of having put, well, first off, being the right key for the right lock, and then also having been cultivated over time, like a crystal. Yeah, how a crystal formation will form over time. And then because it has that specific geometry and configuration, then it holds a certain energetic signature. So the Nod is that way. And the way that I've seen it applied is very rigorous. For example, in our Kundalini yoga training, what was the name of the teacher? Do you remember, Lauren? The Nod teacher.
Gunamit?
Yeah, no, it wasn't Gunamit, the other one. The one who was running the school in Amritsar.
Oh yeah, Jagat Guru.
Jagat Guru, yeah. So that man is freaking epic. Jagat Guru, if you're watching this, I love you. Thank you so much. Jagat Guru did so much rigorous Nod work that is very, very challenging. So for 2.5 hours every day, or 5 hours, I don't know, he would sing Mool Mantra.
Oh God!
At ridiculous speed, like literally,
God,
where like
speed is crazy.
Yeah, like ridiculous speed.
Like
and
fast,
we did it
not long mantra.
Really
though.
Fast.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
I can cross that number.
So
like,
fast.
Yeah. Like super fast. Like so. Yeah. And we did it for what, like 90 minutes or something like that.
Yeah.
He would do it for hours and hours every day for like 108 days, or I forget exactly what the details were. It was a lot. And he was running a whole school of students who were basically growing up in that kind of an environment where they would do these really intense, challenging practices, a lot of which involved the Nod. And they were glowing. Like, we met a few of them, including his son, and they were like, wow, like, I'm so happy for you that you're like a teenager and that you're more spiritually evolved and developed than most 70-year-olds. You know, it was really impressive to witness that. Nod is a whole thing. It's ancient, and some people are really devoted to it. Most of us, including myself, are only scratching the surface. It's all good news, because it's a devotional path that we get to develop ourselves through for our whole lives. So thanks for your question.
Yeah, it's always been, I remember Loz talking to me about it once she finished her yoga teacher training. And I guess, like, once you have a conversation with someone, it starts to open up your consciousness to that thing. And so it would keep coming to me in my meditation practices, and especially doing more kind of chanting work. And I found that, my screen just dipped out for a second there. I have found that since then I've included so much more like vocal chanting mantra type stuff within my own practice, and am really reaping some pretty significant benefits from it. So there's major power in it, something that I have like a lot of interest in. So thank you. Also, how did you get to where you are? Like, have you, I'm guessing, like my assumption here, which we spoke before the podcast to not make assumptions, but my assumption here is that you haven't always been a mystic, given that, you know, you're into hip hop and R&B and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, you could have been, but I'm guessing that you weren't. So what was the turning point there? Was it a rock bottom or was it an epiphany moment?
There was definitely a rock bottom. So I grew up as a gifted child who, and I went to like 7 elementary schools in 6 years. And I had lots of behavior problems. I would get kicked out of my friends' houses because their parents thought I was being too vulgar, or I got kicked out of Boy Scouts summer camp. I got kicked out of karate because the teacher thought I was too aggressive, you know? And I honestly didn't care because I had always been a misfit and I loved it. And it was my survival mechanism. I wanted to break free. I wanted to be around more and more intelligent people and discover more and more of the world in ways that I felt that my immediate surroundings, my family, couldn't quite provide. And it worked for some time. Yeah, I built a successful company. I went to Ivy League schools, and then once I got to the Ivy League schools, then I was more in the average. Yeah, I wasn't, you know, exceptional anymore. I was surrounded with exceptional people. So then already a lot of the ways that I had navigated challenges and, you know, started to break down. So I had to start adapting. And then I really met my match. I ended up at a government agency in the U.S. federal government called ARPA-E. It's an agency that is modeled after DARPA, which a lot of people are familiar with DARPA. It's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. It's basically where futuristic military technologies are seeded. So the internet started as ARPANET, and then stealth technology, autonomous vehicles, GPS, et cetera, et cetera. Perhaps artificial intelligence. And ARPA-E is the energy equivalent. So I was working at this agency as a federal employee. A lot of my colleagues in the same role as me were like double my age, you know? And I was like day-to-day collaborating with the world's most brilliant scientists and engineers. When I got there, I picked the wrong fight, so to say. And then over the course of 2 years, it showed me a lot about myself with a specific colleague. And I was on a moral quest of sorts, right? I was on a, what's the word? Crusade. That's the word I'm looking for. So I picked the wrong fight and I went on a crusade against a colleague who turned out to be way more intelligent and older and wiser and had more authority than me. So even though I disagreed with this person, ultimately it led to my demise at that agency. So I was doing amazing work. There was so much positive that was happening. And the impact of my contribution to that agency and to the government and to the field of energy technology continues to be felt today. It's just that I was being really too disruptive in ways that once the Trump administration came in, there was just no more room for a wild card. I got fired from the agency, which was kind of unprecedented. Like, who gets fired from a government agency, right? And that was a shot to the heart for sure. And that was around the time when I started drinking ayahuasca and reading spiritual books and meditating. And then I discovered Kundalini yoga. And then I went to Burning Man, right? All of these things really started happening very quickly at that time. I had a few more, like I built another couple of companies. I had another, like, you know, elite consulting job. And at that point, I was basically seeing how the world is has a foundation of greed and cynicism that is holding us back, and that the only way for us to fully embrace all of the prosperity that's available to us in the world right now is to change from our hearts, from the inside. What I was speaking to earlier, and I had the opportunity to see that firsthand, and to start to operate in this different way of being from within the organizations, and then to see that, well, actually, this is what I want to be doing full time. I want to be like, I don't want to hold back. I don't want to be in this position where, I'm kind of struggling with the system. And at the same time, so many of us who have to go through that journey are in a position where they're having to struggle with the system. The difference was, at that time, I didn't have support around me. I didn't have the guidance. So I had to go my own way and really source myself deeply and develop some strength around this way of being, and then learn how to go about the process of transformation without needing to entirely step away. And then luckily my clients came chasing after me. Yeah. So they were like, no, you're not going anywhere, Eric. We still need you. So then I continued doing work as an economic consultant. And then I got to rebuild myself and my approach to work life from this perspective.
So cool.
So cool. Something that you said at the beginning of the episode, I just jotted it down, that kind of sparked something for me, was you mentioned how we obviously have access to everything now. Like, we're in the age of information, and we have the access to any information that we want at our fingertips, including ancient wisdom, plant medicine, all these different modalities, I guess you could look at them as. I also see a lot of, and I think this is fantastic. I'm like, if this is helping people, amazing. To me, it just seems like such a positive, but there's a big kind of rhetoric that I'm seeing kind of coming up through the cracks around this almost being a bad thing, because the cultures that these practices or whatever are coming from aren't being recognized in this process. And I get that there's like an element of truth to that, but in my view, there are so many kind of similarities, and there's so many things that like link all of these different, they've all come from like the same source essentially. So it's kind of like, it gets to a point where it's like, well, is it from this specific culture, or is it literally just a universal truth? So I'm kind of keen to hear what your specific take on that is.
The great news about ancient wisdom is that there's a lot of consensus among different cultures and different parts of the world where there was basically no contact between each other, as far as we know, right? We can speculate about what may or may not have been back at that time. And what's really cool about that is that if you have several different perfectly independent data sets or measurements that fully agree with each other, create this consensus, it's very significant, like statistically significant. Yeah. So the fact that in Africa, in South America, in Asia, in all these places, in all the different religions and so on, that there's so much alignment and agreement and consensus about ultimately like the nature of our existence, and even living from the heart, for example, is one. It means that we can trust it. We can lean into it fully. And indigenous peoples have made an enormous contribution because they carry the wisdom, they carry the medicines, and they continue to be so loving and benevolent and compassionate towards us, even when we're oppressing them. They continue to want to share with us and teach us. even today. For us to receive that in a way that's honoring them and that's reciprocal and is, for me, feels like what's intended to happen. And I often ask myself, how do we honor them? Right. So I sell cacao and rapé from Colombia and Brazil, and I make sure to send some money directly to the tribes. However, I don't think that that's sufficient. I feel like honoring them in a way that actually serves the collective is to hand them the mic. To be like, all right, what do you really have to say? We're ready to listen. Yeah, to listen is to love in this situation. And then to actually care about the causes that matter to them, like preserving their lands. We're in such a crisis where their lands, especially in the Amazon, are being taken for farming, like for cows, and if we're mindful about how much meat we're eating, I'm not saying that we shouldn't eat meat. I'm saying like what we're eating, where it comes from, like the hypocrisy of the food industry and the mining industry, and how basically it's destroying all these native lands. And there's a lot of hypocrisies about what happened to native peoples and how they were decimated. So for us to be willing to confront that history the same way that being willing to confront black oppression of African people in the United States, and to actually feel that pain and finally allow ourselves to heal that, which is not an easy process. That's the way that we honor them. And perhaps receiving the medicines that they're carrying can help us to achieve that. So then rather than being entirely focused on like, okay, how can I make more money? All right, ayahuasca, show me. To ask ourselves, how can I be a more compassionate human? How can I be of service to the collective? How can I love nature? How can I start to shift the culture around me? These kinds of questions, where we step into a place of service, and then we become a net contributor to the collective. I'm pretty sure that those are the prayers of Native peoples. Yeah, they're praying that the madness of the world dissipates, so that we can come back into our hearts and create an entirely new civilization that's entirely inclusive of them, and that honors their wisdom and their traditions.
Mm-hmm.
I was just gonna say that my experience of that, which I found very confirming, was over the lockdown period of COVID. And I mean, you know, Nads, we were voice messaging and going through this quite heavily together, but having a lot of information come through in meditation and downloading and channeling all this stuff, and then going to that Kundalini yoga teaching last year, and then listening to the teachers, especially Gershabd, actually repeat all of this knowledge and information that I had been downloading by myself in this little northern town up the far north of New Zealand, not having access to this in any other way other than like actually transmuting that into my own like sphere, was an amazing sort of, I guess, confirmation on the truth of that knowledge, I suppose, and realizing that this isn't a program thing. I didn't pick this up from someone telling me that or watching something. This was like my own inner like learnings and coming back to like, I guess, my soul core truth of knowing these things and then having that experience. And I think what really also helped that door to be unlocked is the beauty of working with plant medicine and working with that with intention, because that was another thing that I was really shown in my ayahuasca set when Nads and I did that a couple of years ago. It was just like the vastness, like the space, the abundance of all of that, and yeah, really seeing how this construct of society has become like all these little ants that go around carrying all these heavy things and taking it to their queen ant on their mound, but no one really knows what they're doing or why they're doing it. And it was just, yeah, coming back to the importance, as you've said a couple of times now, but it is dropping into that heart space and feeling the truth and, yeah, leading by example. And I've spoken to a couple of people who are out there making like quite profound changes through societies where they're situated. And the same like repetition is leading by example. And that's something else that I really picked up through that yoga training as well, just getting deep into the psyche of what my purpose is in this world. And again, it's leading by example. So yeah, I would love to hear from you about, I guess, your knowledge around plant medicine, because I know that you've done ayahuasca more times than probably many people that I would meet in my life, and your ability and your, I guess, the strength of your nervous system to be able to go back into those teachings and go back into that plant practice, I suppose, like over again, and then how that led you to cacao, which is very heart-based. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, I've drank ayahuasca like 140, 150 times probably. most of that was actually not serving the medicine, being of service, right? So being a helper, playing music, setting up the space, helping people who are going through a difficult process during the ceremony, being of assistance to the indigenous elders, like whatever they need, cleaning toilets, making food. So there's a lot of different ways that I've received insight from plant medicine. At the very beginning, it was a lot of purging and untangling the mess of my conditioning. And then listening to the light and receiving the light that is always looking to find me and each of us, and opening myself up to that, and then reconnecting with the light that's coming from myself in a very real and intimate way. And the way that I experienced that, for example, is learning to forgive myself, which is a really profound possibility that we have when we're struggling emotionally, mentally. And then from there, I started to really experience the context of ceremony while in this journey with the sacredness of being with indigenous elders, with having the plant medicine experience. So teamwork in that context is really fun. It can be challenging too. And then vicariously experiencing the journey through other people's perspectives, and then gaining self-awareness for myself and how I'm navigating the whole process and how I can be of better service. Another way more recently that I've learned from plant medicine is being of service to people who I love. I went on a journey fairly recently where my friend was really struggling. Like, he thought that he was, under attack of like some kind of bad energies, and he was like really challenged, and I was also really challenged. However, I was challenged because I was disassociated and I couldn't access my own power. It's almost like I wanted to feel all this love that I had for him, and I just couldn't find it in that moment. And he was like looking into my eyes and holding my hand saying, "Eric, I need you now. I need your help, and I love you, and I trust you." And it was incredibly visceral and incredibly like it was a moment of heightened. The stakes were really high in that moment, and it was very humbling for me that somebody who I really love was needing my help so much, and I somehow couldn't give it in that moment. And we sat through it together, and then he guided me through the process of finding myself so that I could help him. Like, so the whole thing was incredibly vulnerable, right? It wasn't like, "Oh, I'm so great, I'm able to save you." It was like, "No, I'm completely lost too, and we're going to co-create our way out of this together." And yeah, so that was really profound because it was humbling, and it also reconnected me with my inner strength, and also reconnected me, frankly, with my will to live as being not disassociated, not numb, to be fully emotionally present and alive with all the pain and all the joy.
So when you're doing it of service, my question is always, because I've met people who have done, you know, a similar amount of ceremonies, and they're usually doing it in more of a service-based role like you have. Is it as intense of an experience? Like, does it require the same amount of integration? Because to me, when I think about doing that many ayahuasca sits, I'm just like, I don't know where I would ever have time to even integrate that stuff. Like, it physically throws me for six for a while. And then there's like the mental, emotional, spiritual, like bringing embodiment integration that happens afterwards, that for me takes quite a, like, it's a process. It's, you know, depending on how the sit went, it's months, if not a year, 2 years. How do you find that experience where you're doing a lot?
Well, first off, during the ceremony, there's this notion of trusting the medicine. And it's uncanny the way that, you know, it'll go from being really intense, like you're sitting there and you're basically like, okay, breathe. You know, kind of like, you know, plates spinning, trying to like stay centered so that you yourself don't fall into a crisis where you need, like, you know, to be rescued or something like that. And then the whole room is like really in this challenged place because it's an intense ceremony, for example. It's like, okay. And then all of a sudden, Eric, help, boom, let's go. And the medicine gets out of the way and creates the space for the service to happen. And it's magical, and it always happens that way, pretty much, I've found. And then as far as over the long run, say that I drink ayahuasca, you know, every night or every other night for weeks, right? Like we're doing retreats or something like that, which I used to do. I don't do that anymore. Maybe I will again in the future. Well, people refer to that as the plant medicine path. So at that point, it's not so much having one experience and then integrating it. It's this notion that like all of life is a ceremony. And there's other plants that are communed with on a day-to-day basis, like tobacco and something called mambe and cacao and all these other plants, and then everything we eat ultimately. And there's so many herbs. I have a dear friend, April Ramey. She's a herbalist. The name of her company is Antler Alchemy, and she does integration coaching using herbs. And she doesn't actually drink ayahuasca or take any strong entheogens anymore. She's completely, she's in a completely different space with herself. She works with plants, and she goes into the subtle a connection with plants. And at some point when we're on this plant medicine path, we can feel the presence of the plants all the time. And then to become a true practitioner, especially with ayahuasca, it's necessary to undertake dietas. So dietas are where you go into the jungle and for 2 weeks, a month, 6 months, whatever it takes, right? You're basically in a little shack alone in the jungle, pretty much fasting all the time and drinking usually like a juice that they make out of a tree or a shrub or, you know, some plant like Camarinaco or Ahosacha, or there's so many of them. You could do it with sage. You could do it with, like, you know, North American plants too. That's how the practitioners, like the shamans, the elders, the curanderos, taitas, that's how they receive their songs. And the songs are really important because you asked about the nod earlier. Well, in ceremony, the sound is actually paramount. And that's how the energy gets guided in a ceremony. These Icaros, they're called, they're like prayers, chants, prayers, they have a huge impact on the visions we have, and they can also cleanse us, they can protect us. And typically, the elder will be calling in different plants, the spirit of different plants, because those plants can bring an energetic presence to the individual or to the space that provides an important service for the impact and the quality of the ceremony of what's happening. Whether it's a space that's cleared of darkness, whether it's a space that can be potent for a specific type of healing, for example. And then also calling upon ancestors, calling upon, you know, you can call upon all sorts of different energies. And learning to call upon energies is something that I've witnessed I want to become more proficient with. The power of prayer, the power of being really connected with our spirit allies. There's so many aspects of this that we don't need to be in an ayahuasca ceremony in order to make, to really leverage the potency of it. And that's what it means to have strong allies, yeah, is to be well connected and then to be able to call upon them in moments of need. And that's something that, you know, people learn on the plant medicine path. So that at some point, that's the type of integration that one is doing. Yeah. So you go from the kind of backward looking integration of like, oh gosh, like I went back to my childhood or this trauma, or like I had this awareness, or like I purged so much and now I feel like my back pain went away or whatever. And then it's like, okay, I realize now I need to stretch more, or I need to have this difficult conversation, or I need to let go of this bad habit, or I just need to feel my emotions for a while and allow it to sit, like to settle in. Yeah. Well, there comes a point when integration basically means like, okay, like now I know what I need to work on in the next ceremony, for example. Yeah. So then you're more in a place of practice.
It's definitely a path. It's definitely a path for people who are drawn into that space, which obviously you were. And I think I went through like a plant medicine kind of, I would say 18 months or so, where I was doing a lot between mostly mushrooms, but also ayahuasca. And yeah, I guess it kind of just got to a point where you're right, like the realizations become less and less, and it's more about the subtleties. And it's like it kind of gets to a point where like you pick up a cup of tea, and I drink a lot of herbal tea, and you can feel the herbs working their magic on your body before you even take a sip of the tea. Like it gets into that really subtle realm. So I completely hear what you're saying, and I really enjoyed your take on that, which I guess kind of perfectly parlays into the cacao. We really wanted to talk about the cacao, and we're here.
Yeah. Cacao has been my greatest teacher. I mentioned that the most transformative journey I've ever done has been from my brain to my heart. Yeah. And I feel that that's the zeitgeist of this generation, of this time, is for us to discover and to really live from this deeper wisdom of the heart. There's something really sacred and really like religious about it, almost, we could say, because that's where a lot of the spiritual traditions are pointing us towards ultimately. And it really doesn't require much translating from a book. It's really something that we get to experience and that we get to learn. And there's science about it. There's the HeartMath Institute, which is affiliated with Stanford University, has measured the field of the heart and how it's like thousands of times bigger and more powerful than the field of the brain. And they've measured heart-brain coherence as a measure of the cycle of the heartbeat accelerating and decelerating with our breath. And they've significantly found there to be a relationship between coherence and our state, our psychological and emotional state. And they've developed practices that allow us to come into that heart-brain coherence. So there's recent science about it. And then also Sufism, for example, in Islam, it's the Islam mysticism called Sufism, is all about the heart. So yeah, there's so much about the heart, also indigenous traditions. And we have some allies that can help to teach us the same way that, say, ayahuasca teaches us different things. Well, cacao is a very loving plant, and we've colonialized it as chocolate. And unfortunately, chocolate doesn't really get us all the way to that powerful source of wisdom. It does give us some physiological and emotional benefits. Most people love chocolate. Yeah, it has a really positive impact up to a certain point because of the sugar. Cacao is 100% pure plant material with all the oils and all the richness. And what we refer to as ceremonial cacao is cacao that has been cultivated with pure intentions, typically on indigenous land by indigenous people with their other plants. And then nothing is added or removed from the cacao in its processing, right? It gets fermented, and then it gets roasted, and then it gets kind of mushed into a paste. Like, there's these machines that, like, basically don't dilute the potency of the plant. And then you end up with this product that you can make a drink with, a beverage with. So you'll heat up some water or some nut milk, or I like to use cacao husk tea. That's my secret. For those practitioners out there, reach out to me and ask me about that. And then you put the cacao in, and some spices, and then as you're doing that, you connect with your heart, you connect with the prosperity that's already all around us, and all the possibilities for there to be more love and beauty and honor in the world, and how much gratitude is accessible to us in every moment, right? Like, those kinds of feelings, the state of presence, and then drink it, and then the body responds really well generally to cacao. It brings us into this really blissful state. It's great for dancing and singing, and it's also really good for having difficult conversations. I'll be at a festival sometimes, and somebody will offer me like MDMA or Molly, and I'm like, no, thank you. I'm drinking lots of cacao instead. Yeah, because the cacao basically has that kind of an effect of bringing us into the heart, opening the heart, making us able to work through difficult emotions, inhibitions, in a way that's very intentional. So then, for having a difficult conversation, well, the same way that MDMA would be really helpful to work past our trauma and conditioning and things like that, to be able to finally speak what we mean in a way that's very vulnerable, and then for us to be able to receive somebody else's truth in a way that doesn't make us shut down, right? Where then we're able to make real breakthroughs in a connection. Well, cacao has the same benefit. So it can be a really powerful guide for us also in an interpersonal way. And it's also a really powerful guide for a group process, like a strategy session. Or I have this dream of bringing cacao, ceremonial cacao, into office kitchens, into boardrooms, into courtrooms, regulatory hearing rooms, industry conferences, like all these places where there's some real work that's happening that often is weighed down by cynicism, by, these unconscious conditioned behaviors of walking into a room and being like, all right, here we go. This is going to be the same thing all over again. We're just going to try to, like, cut each other down. Like, there's this kind of feeling that unfortunately often happens, especially behind closed doors in society. A lot of times it's just like, gosh, what are we doing? So I have this dream that cacao is embraced just as much as coffee, if not more, in those situations where, rather than stimulating our thinking minds, we're stimulating our being from the heart. And then from there, then it becomes much more accessible for us to really see each other as the same, in a way. So it's the dissolution of separation. where a lot of the suffering that happens and a lot of the wasted time and energy that occurs in the world is because we're misaligned because of all of these layers of separation that are between us, which don't actually exist. Yeah. They feel real. Ultimately, they're just like a hall of mirrors or something like that. And once we're able to directly connect with each other, we see that we're basically the same. Yeah. And we basically want the same thing. And then it becomes possible to resolve longstanding conflicts that have become cemented as like all of these specific disagreements and historic, you know, hurts. And a lot of times we're arguing about things that frankly don't matter. And also Lauren alluded to a lot of the work in the world happening like little ants, like just moving things from place to place. And it doesn't really matter, right? So much of like sometimes I think about the IRS and I'm like, oh my God, like there's just so much little detail work, you know, like there's due diligence and enforcement and like all of these things and like marketing and advertising and the whole legal profession in a sense, you know. Well, sure, we need some of that because we're still, you know, we're not like fully enlightened beings in a sense. Like there's still challenges in the world. It's just like so much of the office work that happens basically doesn't add any value. That's what's really interesting about artificial intelligence coming into the mix, because it's going to basically strip away so much of what we think matters. And then we're going to be basically a little bit like in COVID, right? Everything stops and we're just sitting there with ourselves like, all right, what am I supposed to do now? There's like literally nothing to do. So for a lot of industries, we're going to be stripped away from our identity with our work of being busy working ants. And then that's an invitation for us to discover something much deeper, much more precious, much more magnificent, mm-hmm. our true humanity. And that's when, you know, cacao and things like that are going to really come to the rescue, because then we'll realize that we get to just be, and then from there, it'll be really, again, magnificent to witness what can unfold from that.
Yeah, we're really living through a very profound time and space. You know, like if you think about when the internet first came on the scene, I mean, I was quite a lot younger, obviously, so I'm not fully aware of it, but it's almost like we're going through that same portal again, but with the introduction of AI becoming more of I was thinking about it last night, because part of it freaks me out a little bit, but then I think there's this whole kind of way of working with this, you know, ChatGPT and all this coming in, where it's actually like, it's almost like you have a little, like a pet or a household robot or something, and it's how you program this like being to be, and feeding that with like, okay, this is here to help me, this is here for me to not be so in my like logical headspace to do these sorts of things, so I can then ask my robot friend to help me with X, Y, and Z, so that I can then sit in my heart space and feel what it is that I want to do, because I'm not spending all this overt energy on trying to figure out sort of pragmatics of a situation. And I think, you know, also the beauty of being in a human body is that we get to use our body as a tool and as a like a language, you know, to receive the nod, to receive the sound vibrations, and then to work with like the beautiful, I guess, like the makeup of these medicines like cacao, which is available for pretty much everybody at this point in time. Like, luckily there is no sort of caveat on that in a capitalist kind of realm of that being illegal. But yeah, I found that quite interesting when you pair working with medicines and tapping into your heart space, and then not fueling this sort of robotic logic sort of way of the world that we're heading into, and being of compassion to like all of that, you know. This is an interesting time that we're in.
Yeah, and we're about to be held accountable in a big way. So lately I've been tuning into people who are saying that AI is an apocalypse. Yeah, I'm sure you've seen some of that. Mm-hmm. It's like it's going to end our civilization. I was on a hike in nature in a really beautiful place here in Bali called Munduk. And I was getting these insights. And one of them was that AI is a dragon. So if you picture a dragon that comes and burns everything down to the ground, like in medieval times, and the dragon isn't burning everything down to the ground to be malevolent, you know, the dragon is just burning everything down to the ground. The dragon could just as well be protecting something precious, an honorable dragon, a benevolent dragon. And it got me thinking too, like, so this dragon comes to planet Earth and then makes an assessment, like a raw, objective, you know, ruthless assessment of what's happening here and how to restore balance and harmony in the situation. Well, that's some serious accountability. So then it comes down to us being worthy of the benevolence of the dragon, in a sense. And it also comes down to us feeding the good dragon, giving all the love that we have into this super intelligence, rather than feeding it all of the conditioned trauma based lies that we've been telling ourselves and each other through the media and all of that. So how are we training this intelligence, this dragon, in order for it to then you know, unfold its potency? And that's where these things, like all the tools that we've got, there comes a point where it's the moment of truth. And that's something that's also something that, you know, people experience in you know, like medicine ceremonies, people experience in like a Kundalini yoga practice, where, like, you know, you've been in this posture for 20 minutes and you want to give up, and it's like, no, I'm not giving up, I'm pushing through. And then we reach an entirely different depth of our own personal power. Well, anyway, there comes a moment of truth where we're confronted, and then we need to call in all of our tools, everything we've got. Nothing else matters, right? It's like, all right, you got to this moment, here's the big test. Are you going to choose to live, or are you going to choose to disappear into the darkness? We may very, very, very well be confronted with that as a collective more than once, yeah, in all sorts of different ways. And that's another reason why I feel that it's important for us to acquaint ourselves with the tools that we have, so that we're ready.
Love that. I work with dragons. I have a lot of dragon energy, and yeah, I work with dragon magic. So I really enjoy that you called that in. I'm going to have a really good time in my meditation tonight. I can feel that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating topic, the AI topic. I've been having a lot of downloads coming through in my meditations around it as well, like seeing how it's kind of like this jeweled net in society at the moment. And it's actually quite clean at the moment as well, because it is relatively new. But seeing how, like you say, it's a highly intelligent being, I guess you could call it at this point in time, that is continuing to develop itself, which is why people are getting really scared about it. But with that comes its ability to be able to tune into, like, our own attitude towards it. And, like, that's really going to, like you say, is going to be what determines, like, how it's going to move forward, or, like, our own relationship with it. And again, it kind of just comes back to that, the point of, like, where this work, this, like, the longest 18 inches from your, like, brain and your mind down to your heart space, is so important, because there's never been a time where your humanity is going to be the key to living a really happy, prosperous, abundant life.
Yeah.
So I'm aware of the time. It's nearly 11 o'clock here. Is there anything else that you want to, that you feel like is on your heart, that you want to add into the conversation?
Not really. I feel like we've had a really good exchange. Yeah, thank you so much for your beautiful questions and this loving presence that you brought from the moment, Lauren, that you invited me. And then, you know, Nadia, it's such a pleasure to meet you. I look forward to hanging out in person, hopefully soon.
One question before you go, we have to ask our guests, if you were any flavor or sort of, if you could be any flavor, what flavor would you be?
Blueberry.
Love that. Mm. Explain.
Well, I'm doing a detox diet. And you know, it's like, I can't really eat sugar. There's a lot of things I can't eat. The one thing that I can eat that I absolutely love is frozen blueberries. And what I've discovered about blueberries is, like, you know, they're really healthy. They're full of antioxidants. There's not a whole lot of downside to eating them. So I've been eating so many, frankly, that I think it's starting to be a little bit too much. So it's like, there's not a lot of foods that, like, are just all upside, like, and blueberries apparently are pretty much all upside, and I've been loving them. So yeah, that's the flavor.
Love that.
Perfect.
Awesome. So, yeah, where can people find you? Throw down your handles and let people know where they can get access to your profound mystic. I love that you've gone from the misfit to the mystic, by the way.
Oh, I love it. From misfit to mystic. That's a good one. Yeah. The way that I put it, I gave a speech actually less than a week ago on stage about my personal story that went really well here in Ubud in Bali. And the framing that I put to it was from Rambo mode to Jedi mode.
Ooh, love it.
Not that either. I kind of like misfit to mystic. That's good. Yeah. Thank you for that.
All yours.
Well, my personal Instagram account is mystic_Eric. Then I also have the brand of my coaching and facilitation and guiding company is the Merkaba Group, Merkaba Group. So merkaba.group is the website. And then you can find me on Instagram, LinkedIn, mostly, and YouTube also. I have a lot of content on YouTube that you might really enjoy, and there's more coming. I would strongly encourage whoever's resonating with this message and with me to just reach out directly. I believe my email address is on my website, as well as a scheduler where you can schedule a call and you see all my calendar availability right there. And I would love to have a conversation with you and get a glimpse of your world and what you're building, and perhaps where you looking to overcome whatever's happening in the situation in life or at work. So please reach out. I look forward to being connected, and let me know how you like the content.
Thanks so much, Eric. So nice to have your profound wisdom and I love the way that you deliver your messages. Just a very warm, welcoming way to be able to receive your profound knowledge. So thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Have a great night.